Imagine yourself being a self-realized soul, a pure messenger or instrument, nimitta, like Krishna says to Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita, nimittam matram bhavyasavya sachin. Just become my instrument, Arjuna. Imagine that you are a pure instrument of God, and you had a mission given in disciplic succession to you to deliver the message of pure devotion to a world that knew nothing about it. How would you do that? And that was the mission that was given to my spiritual master, or the founder Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. In the Padma Purana, it describes that even today, intact, and from that time Padma Purana was written to this day as well, intact, there are four disciplic successions coming from the personality of Godhead directly, as in the language of Bhagavad Gita, parampara, evam parampara praptam imam rajarshayo viduhu. So Krishna says to Arjuna in the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita that imam vivasvate yogavam proktavam aham avyayam. Proktavam, I spoke this imperishable science long, long ago to the sun god Vivaswan. And Vivaswan in turn to Manu, and Manu in turn to Ikshvaku, in this way, unbroken disciplic succession. But over the passage of time, the succession has been broken. And so, yoga nashta parantapa, the knowledge has been lost. So now I'm speaking this again to you, Arjuna, to reestablish. The indication being, there must be an unbroken line of disciplic succession in order to receive descending knowledge properly. Just like, imagine a whole series of cables running across the floor. And all of them are plugged into the outlet, and you've paid your electric bill. So electricity is running, but each one of them, there's some break in the line. But one of them, or let's say four of them, don't have a break in the line. So four of them are going to be able to deliver electricity, although there may be so many other lines lying around. So when the line of disciplic succession is broken or deviated, apasampradaya is the term. When the disciplic succession is broken or deviated, the knowledge is lost. So there are four, according to Padma Purana, lines of disciplic succession. The Brahma Sampradaya, Rudra Sampradaya, Sri Sampradaya, and Kumara Sampradaya. They're indicated by name. One of the spiritual masters in our disciplic succession, he's my spiritual master's spiritual master, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, wrote a book outlining what these four sampradayas are, and gave from the very beginning of their being established by the personality of Godhead, the line of disciplic succession unbroken until that present day. And that was something written in the 1920s, 1930s. So, our line of disciplic succession is the Brahma or Brahma Madhva Sampradaya, as in Udupi Madhvacharya established, as Ramanuja did in his principal place of teaching. He gathered the teachings of the previous acharyas, the alvars and others, and consolidated them into one system and systematically presented and propounded and traveled and instructed them. And since that time, from Ramanuja's time, the teachings have remained intact through disciplic succession. In the Brahma Sampradaya, similarly, in the Rudra Sampradaya, in the Kumara Sampradaya, they're still intact today. So as Madhvacharya gathered the teachings of previous acharyas and systematically presented those teachings, in the line in which I'm part of, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared. And those same teachings from Madhvacharya were presented in a very special way, wherein the message of Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan were especially emphasized because in the Bhagavata Purana it's especially emphasized. And along with his teachings came a practice, the practice of the chanting of the holy names of the Lord. When he received his diksha, or his initiation, from a member of the Brahma Madhva Sampradaya, from Ishwarapuri, Ishwarapuri instructed him for 7 days in one verse. And it was in relation to the chanting of the holy names of Hari. The verse is from Skanda Purana. It says, Harer Nama Eva Kevalam. It's easy to remember one because it's repetition. Kalo, in the age of Kali, Nastyeva Gatir Anyata. Really simple. In 7 days he instructed him in that one verse. And unpacking the verse in simple way, in 5 minutes instead of 7 days, is in the Puranic literature, in Srimad Bhagavatam in particular, I'm familiar with the references where in different ages, in the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, there are nine of the 100 sons of Rishabhdev. Lord Rishabhdev was an incarnation of the personality of Godhead. And his eldest son was Bharat. And along with Bharat, the other 99 sons were instructed by him in spiritual teachings. Nine of those personalities became topmost realized, perfected souls, Mahabhagavata Vaishnavas, and they became known as Navayogendras. So the Navayogendras were instructing one king, Nimi, and many, many topics, and one of them was the Yuga Dharma, or the means for achieving perfection in each of the four ages of mankind. In the first, in Satya Yuga, or Krita Yuga sometimes called, the process of dhyan, or meditation, is the prescribed means. Following that age comes Treta Yuga and Yajna, as during Lord Ramachandra's time, Treta Yuga. The performance of Yajna was especially prescribed. And during Dwarpa Yuga, when Krishna was present, the Archana process, the process of elaborate, extensive deity worship, was prescribed. And Karabhajana Muni says that in this age of Kali, the process of chanting the holy name is the primary means for achieving spiritual perfection. Other things are certainly beneficial, but Especially important is the chanting of the holy name. And therefore this kalo nastyeva, nastyeva, nastyeva indicates, Ishwarapuri indicated, while there are other processes for other ages, and one may do them in this present age, they don't have to gati to achieve the goal of the destination or the objective. It's not fulfilled perfectly without the chanting of the holy name, or stated in reverse, the chanting of the holy name gives special strength to any other beneficial activity, to meditation or to deity worship or to a performance of sacrifice, accompanied with the chanting of the holy name is especially effective. So, in this age of Kali, Harer Nama, Harer Nama, Harer Nama, indicating that rule in Sanskrit is when something is said three times, it's purposeful, it is a rule, it means absolute emphasis. It's beyond conventional, meaning if you want to share something with somebody, when you're passing through, to get directions to the place, make sure when you get to the fork in the road you turn right. You'll say it three times. There may be a tendency to turn left because it may look like that's the main road, but make sure you turn right. And there's a little house right in the corner, and you'll see it. It's yellow in color, and make sure you turn right. Because lots of people get lost turning left. So just in conventional, you want to emphasize something, you say it three times. Sanskrit, it's much stronger. It's absolute. Hare Nama, the chanting of the holy names of the Lord, is for this age of Kali, the primary means of deliverance. And on the strength of that teaching of Ishwarapuri, Lord Chaitanya emphasized the chanting of the holy name. And very wonderfully, he engaged not only his intimate associates, but as his teachings and his life, and eventually his life as a sannyasi and his travels throughout all of India took place, that the pronounced gift that he gave first was the chanting of the holy name. Since a number of you from South India, I was just thinking to share this. When he accepted sannyas order of life, He wanted to go to Vrindavan. But he was in such a state of ecstasy, he lost direction. There weren't like good road signs and GPSs and things. So he was just traveling, chanting. Long narration. By a trick of his brother, instead of heading towards Vrindavan, he headed towards an elder Vaishnava's home, where all the Vaishnavas were waiting to see Lord Chaitanya after he had taken sannyas. And his mother was there, and his mother wished for him to stay for some days before making his journey, and she pleaded with him, please don't go to Vrindavan, because I know you want to see Krishna and go to the land of Krishna in Vrindavan, but it's so far from here, from Bengal. But if you go to Puri, Krishna is also there, in the form of Lord Jagannath. He's also there. And many of the devotees from Bengal, they go to Puri, and they will see you, and then they could, when they come back, they can give me news of your well-being. And sometimes even the residents of Puri, they come to Ganga to take bath in the Ganga, at Ganga Sagara. And so maybe you'll come, and maybe you'll come and see me. So please go to Puri. This is my one request as your mother. So he didn't go to Vrindavan. He went to Puri. And many wonderful things happened without, we'd be here for hours describing those wonderful things. But he had an elder brother whose name was Vishwarup, and before he grew up, his brother left home and took sannyas. So he told the devotees in Puri, I want to go find my brother. I've heard he went to South India. I'd like to go to South India and travel all the holy places throughout all of South India and find my brother. It was pretext only, because through omniscience he was aware that his brother had already departed this world. But there's such a nice description of his travels. There's a whole chapter of his biography dedicated to, as he left Puri, heading in the southerly direction, traveling along the road, he was calling out names of the Supreme Lord. Hariharaya Namakrishna Yadavaya Namaha, Gopal Govindaram, Sri Madhusudan, and just calling very loudly names of the Lord. And he was in such a spiritually ecstatic state, as people would see him passing along the road, they'd come, and he's a sannyasi, and they would pay their obeisances and hear him singing of the Lord's names, and he would invite them to sing with him, and they would sing with him, and he'd raise his arms, and they would raise their arms, and he would start dancing, and they would start dancing, and crowds of people would come and just travel with him. And he would turn to them and say, go back to your home and engage everyone in the same chanting of the holy name. And by the time, just through his association, it's described in scripture, but by the association of such a quality personality, spiritually quality personality, one becomes electrified. And as an object becomes filled with electricity, one becomes spiritualized by his association. So they went back to their village, and with arms upraised they would call names of Hari, and others would see their ecstasy and they would raise their arms and chant Hari, and then they'd go to their village and raise their arms. In this way, the author, the biographer said, all throughout, this is just a picture of his travels throughout all of South India, just in ecstatic devotion, engaging everyone that he met in chanting the names of Hari. This was his gift. And so many other nice things to say about that. So fast forward over time, and in 1965, our founder Acharya, who would become our founder Acharya, was given the mission, take these teachings of pure devotion to Krishna to the other side of the ocean, to the English-speaking parts of the world, and give this message of pure devotion to them. So, you have some cartels? Oh, here's some cartels. He got a passage on a steamship at the age of 70. Think of somebody you know that's 70 years old. His age was such that the owner of the steamship line was a businesswoman named Sumati Mararji, and she was very appreciative of the devotional efforts that Prabhupada had and preparing his translations of Srimad Bhagavatam. She helped sponsor the printing of some of the original volumes. So she was like a benefactor, an appreciator. So when the United States changed its immigration law, after World War II, there was no one can come. No tourist visas. Nobody from anywhere. I mean, Europe, to some extent, they don't require visas anyways. But other parts of the world, no visas. But that changed in 1965. And so, knowing that, Prabhupada went to Sumati Mirarji and said, please make an arrangement on one of your cargo ships. Please give me a little cabin where I can stay and cross the ocean, follow the instruction of my spiritual master. She said, no, you're too old. You have no idea what it's like to cross the ocean. You'll die. It's treacherous. High waves and fierce moods of the ocean, and you won't live. But Prabhupada said, this is my life. Without it, I might as well not live. It's my life to fulfill the instruction of my spiritual master. Anyway, after several visits, finally she relented and gave him a passage, and then he had to get a visa. So it's an interesting way how he got the visa. I shared this earlier. He had a previous friend from his business days as a householder who had his son had gone to America and gotten a job and had married an American woman, and so he now was an American citizen from India. Agarwal was his name. So Prabhupada asked his father, or Mr. Agarwal, who was living in Bombay, see if your son can arrange for an invitation for a tourist visa. It was just like, you know, one of those conversations that he would from time to time. So but the son made an arrangement. He sent an invitation letter to his father. So with that invitation letter, Prabhupada got a tourist visa, got on a boat, took his kartals and Radhakrishna deities and his translation of the first canto of Bhagavatam, some volumes in one of those metal trunks, or a few metal trunks, with Bhagavatams, and came to America to fulfill the order of his spiritual master. My first meeting, my first opportunity of being in Srila Prabhupada's presence was with these in his hand. It was at the university that I was attending, and 1968 or 69, where along with a famous, or one might say infamous, American poet named Allen Ginsberg, who liked chanting and liked the Vedas and incorporated teachings from the Vedas in his poetry. And it's kind of like, you know, an Eastern-Western blend of modern poetry, very stylized. But he liked chanting, so Prabhupada had some, he was a celebrity of sorts. And so he and Allen Ginsberg were making a tour of universities and presenting kirtan, chanting of the holy name. So Prabhupada's principle was the Yukta Vairagya principle. Nirbandha Krishna Sambande Yuktam Vairagya Uchate. It's a verse describing Lord Chaitanya's teachings that all those things that have a relationship with Hari should be used in service to Hari. And when using those things without attachment, anasaktasha vishayan, without attachment to vishaya, sense enjoyment, utilizing things that are in relation to Hari, in service to Hari, that's a complete form of renunciation. Yukta vairagya, utilizing things in service to Hari in that mood of detachment. So following that principle, the Yukta Vairagya principle, he traveled with Allen Ginsberg in different venues. So that's where I first met Srila Prabhupada. And I didn't know who he was. I was just facing the crowd at a college campus. And one evening I was passing through the student union, and I saw a whole crowd of people around one of the conference rooms, Millard Fillmore room in the Norton Union. So I didn't know what was going on. I saw all these people. So I wondered what was inside. So I wiggled my way through what was right outside the door, got inside, and with a spotlight on a stage. There was Prabhupada playing kartals and Allen Ginsberg playing bongo drums, which were popular at the time, and chanting Hare Krishna. And the presentation was very simple because of the literally intoxicated condition of the audience. Prabhupada didn't speak so much. He chanted a lot, and at the end of something like an hour and a half to 2 hours of chanting, and then he spoke for about 10 minutes and explained, you know, basics, ABC of this chanting is Golokera Premadana Harinama Sankirtan, is descending from the spiritual world into this realm, delivering the spiritual world into this realm. And it's done very simply. It doesn't require any mental adjustment. Doesn't require any special qualification, regardless of one's birth or regardless of any material consideration. One can receive the purification from the pure holy name through chanting of Krishna's name, and with that comes realization of, you know, etc., you're not this body. He gave a little description of you're not this body, and then he invited people to come to the center that was right across the street from the campus on Englewood Avenue. I didn't know that there was even a center. I didn't know anything. And then, thank you very much, and they served prasadam. That was it. But little did I know what impact that would have on me. My life changed pretty dramatically. I mean, not just that day, but from that day forward, thinking backwards, a greater attraction for of the different kinds of, at that time, spirituality that I was examining and searching, a greater interest in chanting of the holy name came. And gradually, so many things happened. But that's how Prabhupada introduced Krishna consciousness, or the message of pure devotion. Because before giving the message, one's heart has to become cleaned, cleansed. This is the first part of Lord Chaitanya's teaching, Cheto Darpana Marjanam. The consciousness, or the mirror of the mind, becomes cleansed. First thing that one experiences through chanting. And it's a very important something to experience, because when one, even when one goes to receive teachings from a scripture or from a teacher, one is going to hear with filters. You'll call it the modes of material nature. Karmatmakam yena sharira bandha. When, as long as one's, the modes of nature are acting upon one, one is for sure going to think of the self in terms of the body and think of happiness and fruitive activities. In terms of fruitive activities. And when both of those are there, one's mind is colored, and one can't see things properly. Even it's being delivered, you can't see properly, you can't hear properly. The senses aren't functioning properly because they're covered. They're covered with fruitive intention and bodily conception, that were from the seat of consciousness, influenced by the modes of nature. So that needs to be cleansed. The primary means of cleansing, it's like a commercial for a powerful cleanser, the chanting of the holy name, stronger than dirt. It takes away all dirty things of the heart. Vidhunoti suhritsatam, in the language of Srimad Bhagavatam. And then following chanting, some short presentation Prabhupada gave. That's that same format that he used in a public forum became a little expanded when he began presenting spiritual teachings in the Lower East Side of New York City. The discussions were longer because the audience was a little more purified from the chanting. And not everybody could understand what he was saying. His accent was a little different from them for their ear, plus they were covered by the modes of nature. So chanting was the favorite. Well, chanting and prasadam was the favorite. And in between was, you know, the sandwich part, the hearing of the message. But he was very committed to give the message. And this is where the Bhagavad Gita part comes in. So chanting makes the heart pure. It does many other things. It awakens the dormant tendency of the soul to serve the Supreme Soul, because the covered modes of nature model is to use the senses for sense gratification. Yehi samsparshaja bhoga, in the language of Bhagavad Gita. Samsparsha is the senses contacting sense objects with the anticipation of bhoga, enjoyment. But Krishna says, dukkha yonaya evate. That's the birthplace of dukkha. So, but that's the tendency. And to change that tendency, the chanting of the holy name awakens a different tendency. The tendency of serving the Supreme. Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam. Serving Rishikesh, master of the senses, by using the Rishikas, the senses. That's devotion. Bhakti Ruchate. That's a verse from Narada Pancharatra, teaching what bhakti is. It's a definition of bhakti. Without accepting designations as my identity, like, you know, designations of the body, or other designations from varieties of bodily identifications. Sarvapadi Vinir Muktam. Being freed from all designations, being fixed in a spiritual conception, when the senses are engaged in service to the service of the master of the senses, this is what devotion is. So theoretically it's easy. What's the harder work is the tight grip that material conceptions have upon us. Like, it's not just a matter of saying, okay, I won't do material conception program anymore. It would be nice if it was so easy, but it's deeply ingrained, systematically, deeply ingrained. And so proper teachings are also needed. So Prabhupada gave proper teachings. And essential is Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. Because Bhagavad Gita is Krishna speaking, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, just like the Vedas are direct emanations from Lord Narayana, and they're manifested in the form of spiritual sound vibration, Shabda Brahman. And that Shabda Brahman is received by great rishis, and they vibrate them. There's the receiver and the broadcaster component of their... They're very useful. Just like as we're seated here, if anybody has their cell phone on and someone calls your number, there's a signal that we're not going to hear, but the phone picks it up because it's got a receiver if you have it on. And then there's a broadcaster, ring, makes a noise, says, okay, there's a signal. And then you pick, oh. So from some distant place, we use it all the time. The technology is there, material technology, what to speak of spiritual technology, when the broadcaster is Narayana and the receiver is the rishis. And, you know, yes, Narayana. What is it? Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Very well. Om Namo Bhagavate. So the rishis vibrate because they have receivers. So as we sit here, there's so many signals passing through, not just, you know, cell phone signals, but radio signals and all kinds. We don't detect them because we don't have receivers. But rishis are very qualified in that way. Subtle technology of receiving Shabda Brahman. And they manifest that in the form of the Vedas. And similarly, especially, because one of the questions is, what's the how to see the relevance of Bhagavad Gita in this present age? Because that was, Krishna spoke 5,000 years ago. But when he spoke 5,000 years ago, because he's omniscient, he knew that just after his departure, the next yuga would begin. That's this one, Kali Yuga. Because at the time, like at the juncture of Krishna's departure, is when there's this little sandhi, or little interval of time, where just after Krishna's departure, the next yuga begins. Kali Yuga begins. So he was speaking Bhagavad Gita for the people of Kali Yuga. And Vyas wrote it down for the same reason. Because in one of the symptoms of the age of Kali is people have a short memory. They have they're short on a lot of things. Short in piety, and short in spiritual propensity, and short in their patience, and short in their stature, and short in their temper too. That's why it's called Kali, the age of quarrel. Over trifles, people will argue. If it's, you know, they go from one insignificant something to argue about to the next insignificant thing to argue about. What to speak of when there's something that appears to be significant? Then it's war. And it's so symptomatic of the age of Kali. So the message of Bhagavad Gita is especially for this age of Kali. Dharma sangstha panartaya sambhavami yuge yuge. Krishna comes to reestablish in different forms, in different yuge yuge, different ages of mankind, the principles by which people should lead their lives. And he gave Bhagavad Gita at the end of Dwarpa Yuga for the rest of us in Kali Yuga. And Vyasadeva compiled that message in a written form because our memories are short. And so it's the same. Narayana's direct breathing and Krishna's direct speaking. Therefore, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. And within the text of Bhagavad Gita is not just, you know, for people who lived 5,000 years ago and let, you know, a few hundred years or 1,000 years or something pass and it's no longer relevant. It's literally, it's eternally relevant. Within the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks to Arjuna why he's speaking this knowledge. He says, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, this same knowledge I'm speaking to you, I spoke, what's the number, 5 million years before, or 3 million, whatever it was, to the sun god Vibhaswan. What's the number?
120 million.
And Prabhupada in the purport does some calculation of Ikshvaku and his coming, and then Manu, Vaivasvata, when the reign of Vaivasvata Manu began, and that he must have heard before he began. He began when he was qualified, so 120 million years ago. So we can say Bhagavad Gita is not only 5,000 years old, it's 120 million years ago, at least. But we can also say, because the knowledge is the same knowledge, and he even says to Arjuna, you were there too. You just can't remember. You can't remember because you change your body and I don't. I don't forget. You change your body and so you forget. Because when we identify with the body, just like the little baby body that all of us once upon a time had, we don't remember. We can see a little baby photo and say, oh, that was me, huh? But we don't remember because we're identifying with the body. And now that body is gone. Now we're identifying with this one. And while we're here, sitting in the room right now, we're clearly identifying, you know, where we are. But are we going to remember, you know, some time from now? It's called the yuga. We forget. Because we're so much in bodily identification, we very easily forget. And going the other direction, those who become fixed in spiritual consciousness or God consciousness, a symptom is their memory is very sharp. Because it's fixed in sat. And the person who's fixed in sat is not oblivious to what's going on at the moment. But their consciousness is fixed in sat, even at the moment. So one is able to relate in practical terms to what is appropriate for time, place, and circumstance, while at the same time, and thus perform one's prescribed duties, but still at the same time, fixed in consciousness of the Supreme. This is Krishna's teaching in Bhagavad Gita. So the teaching of Bhagavad Gita is as relevant today as it was 5,000 years ago, as it was 120 million years ago, and for that matter, is eternal. As God is eternal, His message is eternal. They're co-eternal. As eternal as one is, the other one is equally eternal. They're equally eternal. And as Krishna presents it, the message doesn't change because the message is eternal. And so it's as if, and Prabhupada taught us this in our, you know, the early days of presenting to people that didn't understand anything about anything spiritual. What an audience to understand the message of transcendence. Big challenge. But because the message is absolute, it resonates with the soul. It can cut through the coverings along with the chanting of the holy name. And he not only taught the message, but he, by example, he taught how to apply it very practically. He showed us by practical example. This is called acharya, one who teaches by their example. He taught by his prachar, but he also taught by his achar. And that's the nature of an acharya. They speak the message of the scriptures, and they live what they speak. And as they live what they speak, they show by example, this is how you do it. So in all aspects of life, cleanliness, cooking, diet, speech, conduct, social awareness, every aspect, an acharya, qualified acharya, teaches. So Prabhupada took this very ancient teaching and gave it its modern relevancy without changing essences. And the same applies today. I'll just share this with you. It comes to mind. When I started practicing Krishna consciousness, my parents went through some changes. The first people like to hear these, like, you know, what was your spiritual journey like? So I'm sharing it for that reason. I'm sure you're curious. Like, how does this happen? So my parents, they thought, oh, he's going through a phase, he's a young man, and he'll get over it. But when I didn't get over it, then the next thing was, uh-oh, what is this? They didn't ask in the uh-oh language, but they asked, you know, do you have any literature that describes, you know, what you're up to? So I sent them the literature, and they did their research. They didn't so much read the literature. They read about people who had, you know, comments about the organization. And so then they became satisfied that it was genuine. And later, one of my sisters, as her son grew up, because we grew up in a Christian family, her son became an avowed Christian. And she told me, I'm very concerned about what my son's in, because what that guy is about is not standard. What you're doing is different than what I do, but it's standard. Mm. I've checked it out. What you're doing is authentic. Because it's just in disciplic succession, age-old teachings and practices continued today. It's relevant today. And then the next thing was we had some nice discussions about, they became accepting. And the message was, if it makes you happy, we see that it makes you happy, that makes us happy. And the subtext was, we really would have liked if you had become a medical doctor and got married and had children so we would have grandchildren. But then, we're happy that you're happy. And then the final phase was, they were proud of me. Because I not only I stayed with it, but I was contributing. They in their own way, they understood I was contributing to the quality of society by spiritual principle, making a commitment to an age where spiritual principle is, there's a vacuum there. So and where there's spiritual principle, upon that you can build other things like goodness and sustainable goodness, because it's based upon something spiritual. So part of the reason, at least my understanding is, part of the reason that we've been invited to come is there's a group of householders like yourselves who gather together in little weekly groups and discuss Bhagavad Gita from Bhagavad Gita as it is. And not only what's the message, but how to apply the message in your daily life in a practical way. I remember one of the times I was, I think it was at your home, one of the times, and you were conducting the class.
Yes.
Yeah. And one of the things we do at the beginning of one of these sessions is, it's got a euphemistic name, an icebreaker. Everyone's all week long has been in all different directions and, involved in their stuff, worldly stuff. And then, get everybody on the same wavelength. So there's a question. What realization did you have this week from the message of Bhagavad Gita or the message of Krishna consciousness? And there was one man sitting, right over there who really wanted to share something. Remember this? And he said, I want to share something. I want to be first. Okay. What is it? He said, when I was very young, I've attended so many of these Bhagavad Gita study groups. And to be quite honest and frank about it, I never really got so much out of it, but I knew it was good for me to do that. And then I heard about this one, and I thought, sure, I've done so many, I'll do this one too, and I started coming. But instead, gradually I started understanding things that I never understood before. And I felt good about it. And so I've been regularly attending. And then my quality, I'm saying it my own way, he said it a little differently, but I have a tendency for anger. Not like really just explode, but just a tendency for anger. And I've tried to work on my anger, and I've not been very successful. Ask my family members, I've not been very successful. But since I started this anger thing has kind of subsided. In fact, just this week, some situation came up at work, and normally I would have gotten really angry, all those people, rah, 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 and I didn't get angry. and thought, wow, what happened to me? I know why. It's these discussions in Bhagavad Gita. It's working. And the chanting of the holy name is working. So he was like, say, we should make a movie of you. We'd just take you around and advertise, you know, come to our Bhakti Vriksha gatherings because it's so beneficial. But it's practical. It changes the quality of one's life by hearing spiritual sound vibration, the holy name of the Lord, and hearing the message of the Lord, Bhagavad Gita, and saintly association, especially when that message is coming into cyclic succession. Then you're receiving through the cyclic succession, discussing in that context. The message is very powerful. It cleanses and it uplifts the tendencies of the soul from the lower modes to the spiritual tendency, to the position of service to God. And it's perceptible. It's experiential. And it doesn't matter age. I mean, it's not just something for old people. Whether you get too old to do anything else, they do that. It's for all ages. Children and teenagers and young adults and persons who are making decisions in their lives. And that's the stage at which I came in contact with Krishna consciousness. And it's not that, obviously you can see there's almost exclusively householders and one other brahmachari and myself. So it's not just for become a renunciate. It's connect whatever it is that is your psychophysical nature and suits you. Connect that with the process of hearing and chanting and conduct your activities according to the codes of theistic conduct. And that's the way in which, that's the incubation chamber in which bhakti grows. And the teachings explain both what and how. How to get your bhakti garden growing nicely. And what's the creeper and what's the weed and how to remove the weed and how to keep the creeper healthy and the stages of development. And the whole, it's all very clearly explained. Very beneficial. Very, very beneficial. I'll just add one thing because it came up in the discussion earlier today, or a discussion earlier today. One of the elements that's most helpful in the way that Srila Prabhupada presented bhakti or pure devotional service, he gave answers to the why questions. Like children may ask their parents why something. Let's say, you know, be vegetarian, why? One of the questions I was asked some number of years ago, a South Indian young man, I'll give his name, he won't mind, Arun Sridharan, his father was a professor at the University of Mississippi, and his mother was a high school teacher in science. And he was a genius. He went to a private school, and he finished his high school education when he was 14, I think. And he was the valedictorian of the state. You know, the gold medalist, as you say in India, when he was 14. And he got a full scholarship at Brandeis University to study. He was on his path to become nuclear physicist, I think. And he ended up getting a full scholarship at Stanford University, and now is a double PhD in nuclear physics and something else. Brilliant person. So I was visiting their home once, and their son had just come after receiving his award and was on his way to go to Washington, D.C. and be honored in the nation's capital for you know, the 50 students in the country that were the top students. So he said, "Is it okay if I ask a question?" And
sure.
In school, this is a why question. In school, the other kids that I associate with ask me, "Why do you believe in God?" Said they say to me, "Wouldn't it be more honest if you just said, 'I don't know'?" And you say that your belief in God creates for you principles of morality and proper conduct. But we say, why not just because it's something that should be done, you do because it should be done? Why not be an honest, agnostic, moralist? And I couldn't answer their question. So I asked my mom and dad. And they said, "Swamiji's coming, you can ask him." And I said, "That's a nice question. I haven't been asked it specifically in that way before. But, you know, I can give you now the answer, but the overall picture is that within the way that Srila Prabhupada presented the message of the Vedas and Vedic wisdom and the message of Bhagavad Gita, he knew the audience. The audience, the Western audience, is trained up. Like, you get A's if you question things. You get B's if you just give rote answers. So it's like, that's the system of education. That's the way people are trained. So he, anticipating that, he gave why answers, or answers to the why questions. So the expression, I gave him a three-part answer. I'll just give you one of the three parts. This is the part that I remember best. I said, I know somebody that works in New York City with the public school. They oversee all the guidance counseling for the entire New York City public school system. Imagine having that job. And they shared with me that there was a study, kind of like comical study, that what it took 10 years ago to get expelled from the classroom and what it takes today to get expelled from the classroom. Maybe it was 15 years or something like that. There were three things. Previously, if you spoke out of turn, you were expelled from the classroom. If you threw a spit wad, that's like, you know, paper, put it in your mouth and throw it and it sticks on the wall, it's a spit wad. If you threw a spit wad in the classroom, you're expelled from the classroom. And if you talked back to the teacher, you're expelled from the classroom. That's, you know, 10, 15 years. Today, if you carry an armed weapon, you're expelled from the classroom. And then another is if you verbally threaten the teacher's life, "I'll kill you," you're expelled from the classroom. And I forget what the third one was. But, you know, I said, just see how the standards have changed. What previously was unthinkable, today is the standard. So now let's go to your model of your friends where, you know, we do the right thing because we just want to do the right thing. So what's the right thing? What is the standard of morality? Over a period of time, the standard of morality has greatly changed. And, it, you know, the degree to which it's changed is shocking. But if there's no absolute standard, it's just vox populi. Whatever people in general think that's what morality is, then that's what morality is. And as Kali Yuga advances, what morality is keeps changing. There's no standard. So conversely, what Srimad Bhagavatam says, what one of the great Mahajans, or great authorities in spiritual knowledge through all the history of time, Yamaraj said, Dharmam hi sakshat bhagavat pranitam. This is from scripture, that dharma can only come from Bhagavan. Pranitam is to establish. And therefore, what is to be done and not to be done is given by God, not by vox populi, or the trend at the time. There is a standard. It is God-given standard. And that's why we accept God, because He is the one who can give standards of what is dharma, what is one's prescribed duty. There's a whole, the sixth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, the whole canto, it's big, 18 chapters, but long chapters, longer than Bhagavad Gita chapters, establishing that the chapter heading is prescribed duties for mankind. And just, I was thinking before, I was contemplating projecting something on the wall here, of going through the beginning parts of sixth canto Srimad Bhagavatam under prescribed duties for mankind, because of how we seated, I decided not to do that. But the prescribed duties for mankind, keeping it very short, is in different categories. There's karmakanda, gyanakanda, and devotional service, or Bhagavat Dharma. To counteract sinful reactions, one can perform atonement. It's not doing justice to the subject matter, but I'm trying to do it quickly. The conclusion that's presented by Shukadev Goswami, the speaker of Srimad Bhagavatam, is the very best of all dharmas is direct devotional service to the personality of Godhead, beginning with the chanting of the holy name. Nam Adi Bihi. Beginning with the chanting of the holy name. It's the best. It's the best because it not only checks, it not only removes by chanting of the holy name, it removes the reactions to the sins of the person who's chanted the holy name, but it takes away the tendency to do those things again, uproots the tendency for going away from the Supreme Lord and acting in opposition to, in disharmony with the will of the Supreme Lord. It carries one to the position. Its potency is it carries the soul to the position of simply taking shelter, sharanagati, taking shelter of the personality of Godhead in devotion and love. The power, that such power is there in the holy name. So now that's a full circle. We encourage, as did Lord Chaitanya encourage in his travels in South India, as his spiritual master encouraged him to chant the holy name. Following in that same line, we're encouraging, wherever we go, the chanting of the holy name of the Lord. It's nice, it's fun. We have festivals, like, you know, big public festivals, Rath Yatra, Lord Jagannath put on a cart, in New York it's down Fifth Avenue. In Washington, D.C., it's along with the Independence Day parade with, like, you know, nationally televised, a zillion people watching it and so many people in it. So we have, at each of these events, all around the country, we have little booth where we just have people chant japa. He's one of the ones that's responsible for engaging people in chanting japa, right? You're with the japa booth? I lost track of how many, but something like 5,000 people that never chanted japa before sat and chanted one round of japa. You know, the Washington D.C. Rath Yatra downtown, and you know, right on the lawn in front of the White House, some, you know, over 1,000 people chanted japa. And somebody took home beads and said, oh, I like this, I want to chant. The New York Rath Yatra was 750, and just the Chicago Rath Yatra, how many? Something like 750. Just that alone. Their spiritual life has begun. And a little book that explains what it is. But even if they don't know what it is, it's powerful. The potency of the holy name is transcendental. So we like engaging ourselves, engaging others in contact with the holy name of the Supreme Lord. Any of the names of the Supreme Lord, that's fine. But chant the holy name. Hare Nama, Hare Nama, Hare Nama Eva Kevalam. And then side by side guiding our activity with proper knowledge. How do we conduct our life in the quality of goodness and according to theistic conduct? What's the standard? Those two together carry one to the destination. The realm of Vaikuntha, that the spiritual world. We belong there. This atmosphere is not good for us. It's toxic. It can carry us to the pure state that's our natural condition, along with our carrying out the practical duties of our lives. Going forward with chanting of the holy name and proper direction in our spiritual life through systematic study of devotional teachings, we'll get there. Purification we can experience subjectively, step by step as we move. And in the association of others who are similarly making those efforts and progressing, it's strengthening. It helps through this kind of association. So I'm happy to be here with you. Thank you for your inviting us to come and sharing these thoughts with you. Hare Krishna. So, if there's any comments or questions, I'll be happy to respond.
I have a question.
Yes.
First of all, pardon my ignorance. Question regarding about I think of it as when you talk about the word, you talk about the creation. It's created by God, right?
Yes.
It can't be the bad place because it's created by God. So why, instead of looking in moksha, how to look for the purpose of your life? Because if God created you, you must have purpose.
Okay. I don't see the dilemma. If God created us, there must be a purpose, yes. Now, what's the dilemma?
The dilemma is, why look for moksha when it's the godly word?
Well, a few things. The teachings that I've been trained in, Srimad Bhagavatam in particular, teaches that one should not aspire for these four, dharma, artha, kama, moksha. But rather, as Krishna says at the end of Bhagavad Gita, sarva-dharmam parityaja, and with it the rest. Mamekam sharanam braja. That's what we should aspire for. So, there's a purpose. The purpose is not moksha. The purpose is to restore that natural affinity for the Supreme. We're part and parcel of the Supreme. Mami vamsa jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. We're part of the Supreme, angsa of the whole. We've forgotten that. The purpose of life is to remember that and to conduct our lives accordingly. So, for sure, two things are sure: death and taxes. So, death will come. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, for what is one that which is born, death is certain. So death is certain. Where will the soul go after this life? Should I try for moksha? Or should I try for reconnecting the individual soul with the Supreme Soul in devotion? So, if I connect the individual soul with the Supreme Soul, then Krishna can do with me whatever he likes. There's one of the teachings of Lord Chaitanya says explicitly that you can do with me whatever you like. I'm not asking for liberation. Mama janmani janmani jamanishvare bhavatad bhakti rahitu kitvai. Birth after birth, if you wish. Na dhanam, na janam, na sundarim. I don't want wealth. I don't want beautiful wife. Speaking from the male perspective. I don't want followers. What do you want? I don't want liberation. Mama janmani janmani shari. What do you want? Bhavatad bhaktir ahaituki twayi. That's the purpose, to come to that stage. Hetu means cause, and ahaituki is service without a cause. That's love. When you serve someone, not because you want something, just because you love that someone. That's the purpose of life, to come to that stage. And when that stage comes, Krishna can do with me whatever he likes. There's another verse. He says, you can crush me with your embrace. You can neglect me and leave me brokenhearted. You can do with me whatever you like. I'm your servant. I simply wish your service in whatever situation. So it's not an aspiration for liberation, explicitly. It's an aspiration for being situated in that pure love for the Supreme. In that state of the pure love for the Supreme, Krishna teaches in Bhagavad Gita, wherever the mind is fixed at the time of death, that state you will attain without fail. You're familiar with that from Bhagavad Gita? So, if one is fixed in pure devotion to the Supreme, likely that's where you're going to go, to the abode of the Supreme. But if he so desires, he may give one some service somewhere else. Or, you know, any situation. There's a very nice, appropriate for your question, very nice verse. Speaking about King Chitraketu, where he's being appreciated by Lord Shiva as having no interest of Svarga, Apavarga, Narakeshu, Apitu Yarta Darshanam. So a person who is Narayana Paraksarge, person who is completely attached to Narayana, as was King Chitraketu, he's totally indifferent to the attainment of Svarga, heaven, liberation, hell, Naraka. Only one thing: service to Narayana. That's the goal of life. Come to the stage of completely attached. This is so in keeping with your question. God has created this place. There is a purpose. The purpose is to restore that consciousness. That's the opportunity given to us in the human form of life. Not just work, do fruitive activity, and enjoy the fruits of your fruitive activity and die, but do it piously. It's far more than pious activity and enjoy the fruits of pious activity in this life and the next life in heaven. Far more than that. It's the dormant consciousness of pure devotion to Narayana or Krishna or Nrisimha or the personality of Godhead. Here's a message for you. Does that address your question? Okay. Anything else? Yes.
You mentioned that we can chant any names of the Supreme Lord. I remember a discussion that I've read before that there are secondary names of the Supreme Lord. So would chanting of the secondary names of the Supreme Lord also have the same effect?
It's a little technical.
Okay.
For the situation here.
Okay.
I'll answer it because you've asked it.
Okay.
There's a writing called Hari Nama Chintamani. It's the title of the book is taken from a verse from Padma Purana that speaks about the holy name. Nama Chintamani Krishna's Chaitanya Rasa Vigraha Purnashuddho Nityamukto Abhinatvam Nama Namino. So the first line is the holy name acts like Chintamani. So in that book, Harinama Chintamani, it is said, there are any of the names of God purify one's existence. Those that are secondary names are names that identify his post, like Ishwara or Parameshwara, Parabrahman, like that, the post of God, Adhokshaja, or Ajita. He never comes in contact with matter, never becomes fallen. These are terms or names that identify the position or post. And then there are names that identify his intimate activities and his relationships with those in the spiritual world. And those primary names awaken more than purity, they awaken very special love for the person. Both will purify, and the higher state of love is what is invoked through the primary names. Yes?
The question about the relevance of Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah.
So, what is the essence of the Bhagavad Gita? And how is that, like, if we look at ourselves as a spirit soul, and then if you connect to the essence of the Bhagavad Gita, so it is ever relevant. That correct?
Yeah.
It doesn't
matter time, place, circumstance. It's not created by the circumstance or destroyed by the circumstance. It's beyond circumstance or passage of time. So you're making a statement, but you're also asking a question. What is the essence?
Yeah, I was thinking from a you know, a new reader, Bhagavad Gita has 18 chapters. Like, you know, okay, this is three modes of material nature. Yeah, all that. But then what is the essence of the Bhagavad Gita? And then if I understand who am I, then how does that essence connect with who am I? I'm trying to ask you if you can elaborate on the essence.
Well, essence was already discussed. To come to that position where our consciousness is fully connected to unconditional love and service to the Supreme. When that consciousness is restored, that's the essence. One can say it in the simple language of Bhagavad Gita, the same verse I referred to, Sarvadharmam Parityaja Mam Ekam Sharanam. Mam Ekam Sharanam. That's the essence. All the other messages are to help one come to that position. Mam Ekam Sharanam. Krishna Eka Sharana. Full shelter in the personality of Godhead alone. And then going back to the earlier message of Bhagavad Gita, that we're not this body, so it's the soul that's connecting with the Supreme. To assist the soul connecting to the Supreme, we use our other faculties. We use our body. We use our mind. We use our intelligence in service to the Supreme. And that way we take shelter of the Supreme.
And that's how you connected that the Narada Samprapta was.
Yes. Yes. Rishikena, Rishikesha Sevanam. Senses engaged in the service. What's behind the senses, there's several parts to that. It's practical activity. That's one of the messages of devotion or bhakti. It's not just a feeling. I feel devotion. There's practical activity connected to that feeling of devotion, and that's the senses engaged in sense activity, in contact with sense objects, recognizing the senses and the sense objects are meant for Krishna service, not otherwise. So what's behind that is submission to Krishna. Mam ekam sharanam. So the soul surrendered to Krishna includes, the subset of it is, the senses, the mind, manmana, the intelligence engaged in Krishna service. We use the gifts that God has given us in His service. And if there's not appropriate service for Him, like the tortoise with his limbs withdrawn, we're not involved. I'm thinking of one experience I had with I travel a lot. Maybe more than what I should, but I travel a lot. And there was a flight. It was a non-stop flight from, I can't remember. I think it was one of those American Airlines non-stop flights from Delhi to Chicago. I don't know if they still do that anymore, but it did that for a while. And I can't sleep on planes. I can sleep in cars, really easy, but I can't sleep in planes. So I have figured out a way to survive those long flights. I have projects that I work on. Things that I don't have time because my life is busy, and I just fasten the seatbelt and I'm hooked into the project. And so this nonstop flight, the whole way, I was just absorbed in this. I don't even remember what the project was. It was just absorbed, the whole flight. And the stewardess kept coming by saying, what would you like? I said, no, thank you. So she was wondering what's going on. I said, I brought my own. I'm vegetarian. Well, we have vegetarian food. No, it's okay. I brought my own. I didn't want to get into explaining prasadam and all of that, plain food and stuff. So, and nonstop. I was just doing, my thing. And she, towards the end of the flight, she came over and said, the stewardesses are in the back and they want to know, who are you? Because, you don't eat our food and you don't even sleep. You're doing something. I forget the words that she used. Not exactly who are you, but yeah. What is it that you're committed to? That was it. Thank you. What is it that you're committed to? And I said, the right question is, who is it that you're committed to? Because it's not the activity. And she went, oh. And then she came back and she said, they want to know, who is it you're committed to? And it came a third time and said, this is going to be one of my most memorable flights of Delhi to America. Usually it's kind of uproarious and stuff, but this has been really nice. And I gave her a book and said, I'm definitely going to read it. And if I have any questions, can I write to you? She didn't write, but the essence can be demonstrated through practical activity. Even, you know, the stewardesses weren't really so much interested. There was more curiosity than, I want to be part of what this is. They were curious. But Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, that's one of the ways in which people find out about devotional service. They're just curious. Traveling like this, I get lots of curiosity questions. Like, do you mind if I ask you a personal question? No, go right ahead. Are you part of some religion? Depending on the person, I give different answers. It's not Halloween. I don't usually say that. How did you know? Well, you know. Anyway, sometimes they don't say, are you part of religion? They say, are you a Buddhist monk? And I say, no, I'm a Krishna monk. And they go, oh, what's that? And then I get a chance to tell them about Krishna. It's fun being a devotee. Anything else? Yes.
I'm just asking this question on behalf of an email that I sent you recently about chanting of the holy name in a disciplic, taking the initiation formally from a spiritual master in a disciplic succession.
Yeah.
Versus just chanting the holy name and trying to, you know, get there. So the person just wrote back to me and says, are there any examples in the second category? Like, we know
yes.
The examples.
So yes. Shukadev Goswami. Specifically in the Bhagavatam it says he did not receive diksha. He heard Srimad Bhagavatam, the essence of Srimad Bhagavatam, from his father Vyasadeva, and it specifically says he did not undergo upanayana or any procedure. He just left home. So if one is so qualified like Shukadev Goswami, the chanting of the holy name is sufficient. And if, just in case you're not that qualified, then the diksha is also not, not optional. Mandatory. Divyam gyan yato dhyadhyad kuryat papasa samshaya. So at the time, when initiate, diksha means that Divya Gyan is imparted and transcendental knowledge and sins are eradicated. Of course, sins are eradicated just from chanting, even without initiation. But a formal establishing formal connection is necessary, unless one is very exceptional personality. And there's a long purport that describes that, like a 5-page purport that describes that in Chaitanya Charitamrita. I can refer you to that. Okay. Looks like we're done. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. See the Prabhupada ki jai.